Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This week on Radio EcoShock, we are listening to interviews by Daphne Wysham of Earthbeat. Let's pick up with her guest, Ann Peterman, Executive Director of the Global Justice Ecology Project. Are you ready for GE-modified trees like the eucalyptus?
And the trees that they're looking at commercializing are actually eucalyptus trees, which, first of all, are not native to the North American continent or anywhere in the world except for Australia. But industry loves them because they're fast growing. And so they've been manipulating them to be cold tolerant so that they can actually grow all along the Gulf Coast of the United States, where they've never been able to grow before. And we believe it's very dangerous. Not only are these things very invasive, as anybody in California already knows, but they're extremely flammable, and they suck up a lot of groundwater. You know, wildlife can't live in these places, and yet, you know, international paper is talking about doubling the acreage of plantations in the southeast from 42 million acres to 84 million acres using these genetically engineered eucalyptus trees.
What is so dangerous? I mean, obviously, eucalyptus trees sound like a particular class in themselves. I mean, they, as you've mentioned, they soak up a lot of water. They're fast growing. They alter the pH of the soil. What is another reason to be concerned about other types of genetically engineered trees?
Right. They started, I think, my theory is that industry started with the trying to commercialize eucalyptus trees because there aren't native eucalyptus trees in the North American forests. So they felt that they could cut off the contamination argument. Unfortunately, they're also very invasive. But, you know, putting that aside, that is a major concern about the other species of trees that they're engineering. So they're engineering pine trees, poplar trees, and assorted other trees with the idea of also releasing them commercially on a large scale at some point. And those trees have with them the problem of contamination. It's almost certain that they will eventually, the pollen and seeds will spread and they will contaminate native forests. And you won't be able to stop that once it starts. That's the thing. If you have poplar trees in a plantation and they start to contaminate the native forest, the native poplars in a forest with these genetically engineered traits, there's no way to know what trees those are, and there's no way to stop it. So it's an irreversible problem. And who knows what the impacts will be? They are engineering poplars, for example, to be insect resistant, which means that every cell in the tree contains the toxin, the BT toxin.
What is BT?
BT is a, it's a natural, it's actually a natural insecticide that
what
they've, Bacillus thuringiensis. And it's a natural pesticide that is used actually by organic gardeners, but biotechnologists have figured out how to take that gene and insert it unnaturally into plants so that they express this pesticide in every single gene of, excuse me, every single cell of the tree, which means that it will kill whatever insects try to eat the tree or plant. And so that's a very big problem when you talk about that escaping into a forest. Forests, obviously, insects are a crucial part of it. They're part of the web of life. Studies have also shown that wildlife that eat the insects that have eaten the BT, that it continues to have effect up the food chain. So, you know, what will be the effect on songbirds that are eating these caterpillars that have eaten this BT? We don't know. There are other traits that they're moving forward with, like reduced lignin. Lignin is what they need to take out to make paper and biofuels and so on. So they're trying to make these low lignin genetically engineered trees.
Okay, before you get on to lignin, just on the poplar trees and the BT insecticide that's sort of part and parcel of this genetically engineered tree. Why are these trees being genetically engineered in this fashion? What's the ultimate goal here?
The goal, well, the goal of the BT is that you can have a mass plantation of the exact same tree and it won't be infested with insects. And that's been a big problem with some of these monocultures. They, for example, in China, they were combating desertification with these massive poplar plantations, and they found that they were being completely wiped out by insects. And so, you know, the UN stepped in and said, well, we can help you with that. Let's try some BT poplars. And so now they have these, you know, millions of BT trees growing across China. They haven't documented where they are. The Nanjing Institute of Environmental Science in 2005 released a report saying that they were already contaminated the native poplars. So, yeah, I mean, you know, they want to be able to use the industrial agriculture model on forests and have these massive plantations of the exact same species and not have to worry about insect infestations, which is the natural, you know, foe, I guess you could say, of that type of monoculture.
Now, you were about to mention lignin, and you also mentioned pine trees as another type of tree that is being genetically engineered. Is the lignin being engineered out of pine trees? Is that what's happening?
Pine is actually the tree that they're using more for improving wood quality. So, because pine is what's largely used for construction materials. So trying to reduce the branching in pine trees, also making them insect resistant, improving the wood quality. And so, I mean, basically, if they could grow 2x4s in the forest, that would be their ideal. But yeah, so that's kind of a different series of things that they're doing. But they also use pines for paper, so I don't recall if they're doing low lignin pines. They probably are, but they're definitely doing low lignin poplars for paper. And the thing about lignin is that it's what protects trees from animal browsing, from wind, from cold, from environmental stresses. It's basically what protects a tree from all of the different elements that may impact it. And so when you reduce the lignin, which you have to do to make them more easily pulped for paper or turned into all of these other products, you just don't know what the impacts are going to be when you put that out in the wild. Is the first windstorm going to wipe them out, or, you know, are they going to spread their pollen and seeds into the forest and create very weak versions of that tree in the forest that then have unknown impacts on the forest? Low lignin trees also store less carbon in the trees themselves. 70% less carbon in the trees themselves, 30% less carbon in the soil. So they're and they rot more quickly, releasing the carbon back into the atmosphere very quickly. So they're sort of, if we're talking about trees and climate change, they're sort of going in the exact wrong direction as far as what we need to do in terms of reforestation for sequestering carbon in forests.
Now, I had heard that they were trying to genetically engineer pine trees in Sweden in order to reduce the lignin content in the native pine forest there, because they had developed biodigesters that essentially took pine trees and turned the pine pulp into a kind of biofuel. Is that something that you know about and could speak to?
Definitely. They wanted the second generation biofuel technology is very much focusing on trees because they are one of the most reliable feedstocks. You can harvest them year round, whereas many of the grasses, miscanthus and switchgrass and so on that they're looking at with biofuels, often you can't harvest them year round. So you have a part of the year where you have no feedstock supply to manufacture the liquid fuels. But the technology problem is very serious. They cannot figure out how to economically transform cellulose from trees into liquid fuels. And that's one of the reasons that they're genetically engineering them to have low lignin, is then they'll be more easily digested into liquid fuels. One of the other technologies that they're looking at is actually putting an enzyme, genetically engineering an enzyme into the tree so it can start to digest itself prior to cutting it down and, again, enhance the process. So, they really would like to have trees made into liquid fuels and electricity and textiles and plastics and so forth using these genetic engineering technologies, but there's a lot of technological hurdles that they need to get over first, and I really don't think they're going to be able to do that.
If you've just joined us, I'm Daphne Wesham. This is Earthbeat. We're speaking with Ann Peterman. She's the Executive Director of Global Justice Ecology Project. We're discussing the issue of genetically engineered trees for use both as biofuels and for other uses that industry sees fit to engineer them for. For example, eucalyptus that are fast-growing. What is the main purpose of these fast-growing eucalyptus trees for industry?
Right now, it's mainly pulp. So pulp for paper, pulp for cardboard. And now they're starting to move into the biomass area of burning wood for electricity. The UK, for example, is really barreling ahead with using trees to produce electricity. So that's the new thing on the horizon for forests, is burning them for electricity. There's not much technology that you need to be able to do that. It's pretty much already there.
So one of the things that many of us will notice if we pick up our electricity bill, we'll see that our local utility is switching from coal to biomass as a form of electricity. Is this a positive development? Is it a negative development? How common is it across the United States?
There are many, many proposals across the United States in many different states to create more biomass burners, to start switching over coal-fired power plants to biomass, or in other words, trees, to produce the electricity, and to start constructing new biomass facilities. In most of the cases, these are being very heavily fought by local grassroots organizations that see these biomass plants as a major threat to forests, and they are. They consume an enormous amount of wood per megawatt, and many of these plants are quite large. They're servicing large areas of population. So the threat to forests is quite extensive, especially when you look at the cumulative impact of all of these plants. And then there's the carbon problem. People argue that these plants are carbon neutral, that, you know, we're burning the wood, but we're also growing trees to replace them. But when you look at the real analysis of the pollution coming out of these things, it's a very serious problem. There's a lot of health impacts associated with burning wood, all of the different particulates that are in the air. It's one of the dirtiest forms of energy that there is. And carbon-wise, if you look at the full life cycle of harvesting the trees, transporting them, and then burning them, they actually produce even more carbon emissions than coal. So overall, environmentally, biomass burners are not a very good alternative to coal.
So what can be done? We have genetic engineering of trees on an experimental level and apparently on a mass scale here in the United States. What can be done by people that are concerned about this issue?
Well, at this point, the GE trees have not been commercialized in the United States. They're still in the testing phase. The USDA is currently considering an application by a genetically engineered tree company for commercialization of genetically engineered eucalyptus. They will be sued. I know that for a fact because we will sue them. And, so it's going to be a long time before they ever get these trees actually commercialized. But what people can do is to write the USDA, and people can do that from our website. They can sign our petition to the USDA saying we don't want genetically engineered trees in the United States. We don't want them commercialized here. We don't even want them in test plots here, because that means once they perfect them, they'll put them somewhere else in the world. We don't want that either. So people can sign on to our petition, or they can write to the USDA directly and say we do not want genetically engineered trees. You can learn more from our website, all kinds of things that people can do. There's a video. There's a short 5-minute little clip that we made for last year's International Day Against Monoculture Timber Plantations. There's all kinds of things.
And the website is?
The website is nogetrees.org.
Great. Well, thanks so much for speaking with us today. Ann Peterman, Executive Director of Global Justice Ecology Project. Any final words?
Stop GE Trees.
Thank you.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm glad you're here to join us. That website for genetic engineering of trees and how to stop wild trees from being industrialized is nogetrees.org, nogetrees.org. We are showcasing interviews by Daphne Wysham, host of Earthbeat Radio. That program is reorganizing. Find out more at earthbeatradio.org. Wrapping up today, who could have predicted 3 Japanese reactors would melt down, spraying that country with radioactivity? Some radioactive particles arrived in North America and in Europe. Helen Caldicott warned us about this for years that this could happen. Here is an interview where Daphne Wysham talks in studio with Dr. Helen Caldicott on October 22, 2009.
Joining me at the offices of the Institute for Policy Studies is Dr. Helen Caldicott. She's a pediatrician and the co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, as well as the group Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament. She has spent nearly 40 years writing and researching the dangers of nuclear radiation. She's the author of the book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. Thanks so much for joining us today, Helen.
That's a pleasure.
Let's start with the health impacts of nuclear power. Dr. Caldicott, could you give us an overview of the dangers?
Well, we mustn't forget that nuclear power is the prodigal son of nuclear weapons, and it's the same energy released inside nuclear power plants, E equals MC squared, as released when you blow up a bomb. The mining of uranium is dangerous. It's radioactive, and I haven't got time to go through all the daughters of uranium. Suffice it to say, one of them is radium that gave Madame Curie leukemia and her daughter leukemia. It's dangerous to mine uranium. In the past, 30 to 50% of men who've mined uranium have died of lung cancer. And also they're exposed to low-level whole-body radiation, so their testicles get irradiated, which are the most important organs in a male body in terms of evolution and genetic disease. The uranium passes through a series of processes to be made into fuel rods and packed into a reactor. When the reactor, 100 tonnes are put in a reactor, the moderating rods are lifted out and the whole thing reaches critical mass. It doesn't explode, but atoms start breaking apart spontaneously. 200 new elements are formed, man-made. Some last seconds, some last millions of years. The reactor can't operate without routinely releasing radioactive materials into the air and into the water. A new study done by Germans, and they're very meticulous, looked at 16 reactors and children under five years of age, less than 5K from the reactors, and found more than double the increased incidence of leukemia, and their cancers are higher too. And this is a pretty definitive study supported by various meta-analyses that have been done. Not many people do epidemiological studies because they're very expensive, they're time-consuming, the government doesn't want to pay for them, neither does the nuclear industry, because I'd rather not find out what's going on. Now, apart from living near a reactor being dangerous, and I could go into the various elements, but I won't, but, you know, if you live near a reactor, your food's going to be somewhat radioactive, as it imbibes tritium, which is a potent carcinogen, and other elements. The main thing about nuclear power is the production of massive quantities of radioactive waste, which must be stored isolated from the environment, according to the EPA, for about 250,000 years. That is a physical and scientific impossibility. So far, the nuclear industry, just in America, has made about 64,000 tons of this stuff. It sits in cooling pools, some atop the reactors on their roofs, open possibly to terrorist attack. A reactor contains as much radiation as 1,000 Hiroshima bombs, but the cooling pools storing the radioactive waste over years contain 2 to 30 times more radiation than in the reactor core. So they're open to terrorist attacks, and a meltdown in a cooling pool would be catastrophic, according to a study at Princeton University by von Hippel and others. The reactor itself is dangerous. It could melt down. We've had two major meltdowns, one just 13 miles from Hershey's Chocolates. I won't go into all of that, but I advise people as a doctor not to eat Hershey's Chocolates. They're only 13 miles as the crow flies from Hershey's. There was such a release of radiation, the monitors went off scale within the first few minutes. So no one knows how much got out.
And this was where?
This was in Pennsylvania, in Three Mile Island. At Pennsylvania, and Hershey's is just next door, and they built two huge reactors in the middle of the richest daring area of America. I mean, what? I can't understand why anyone would do that. Anyway, apart from a meltdown, which could, a meltdown near New York, Indian Point, which is 35 miles from the center of Manhattan, could kill thousands of people acutely in the first week, vomiting, bleeding to death, and losing their hair. And then 5 years later, there'd be an epidemic of leukemia, depending upon which way the wind blows. But say it blows towards New York, and then an epidemic of solid cancer. It could kill 800,000 people or more. If the terrorists had flown into the two Indian Point reactors instead of the two World Trade Towers, they would have destroyed the richest financial city in the world. They didn't, because they thought that the reactors were protected by missiles. No reactors are protected by anything. And, you know, Sweden got to within about 2 minutes of a major meltdown like Chernobyl a couple of years ago. So it's not if but when. The possibility, according to a nuclear engineer, is about 1 in 10 in America in the next 10 years. Now, apart from that, the radioactive waste, which is leaking in various parts of the country, the elements like strontium-90 that causes bone cancer and leukemia last for 600 years. Cesium that causes brain cancer, muscle cancers, various cancers, last 600 years. Plutonium, which causes lung cancer, liver cancer, bone cancer, leukemia, damages the developing embryo so it's born grossly deformed, and actually concentrates in testicles, damaging the genes in the sperm. That lasts for 500,000 years. And that's, you know, that's just a few elements in the radioactive waste. And it's leaking now, and these elements bioconcentrate back in the food chain, as in algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish, humans, or grass, cows, cow's milk, breast milk, babies. So you can't dilute radioactive waste. The solution to pollution by dilution is fallacious when it comes to radiation. And we as physicians predict, and I just addressed the National Academy of Pediatrics a couple of days ago in Washington, D.C., we predict epidemics of malignancy, particularly in children who are very radiosensitive, and epidemics of genetic diseases, of which there are now 23,000 described, for virtually the rest of time. And it's very important to know that all other species have genes, they get cancer, and they develop genetic abnormalities too. So we're talking about one of the biggest, or the biggest public health hazard the world will ever see, but we'll all be dead. It will be after we've died. That's the legacy we leave to our future descendants, so we can turn our lights on for a few years. We're running out of uranium. I mean, this is a really crazy but very, very medically dangerous industry. It's a cancer-inducing industry, and it's a bomb-making industry, because any country that buys a reactor can make a bomb from the plutonium generated. So it increases the threat of nuclear war as well.
Well, that's quite a summary of the severe health impacts of nuclear power. Dr. Helen Caldicott, we're often hearing that nuclear power supplies energy without adding to the problem of climate change. I wonder if you can walk us through that claim.
Yes, I address this issue in the first chapter of my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming. If you look at the industrial infrastructure that underlies a nuclear power plant, a lot of CO2 is created, not as much as coal, but a lot is. I come from Australia, where 40% of the world's uranium resides, and you should see the size of the trucks. They're just ginormous, and the huge shovels, and you can just see the smoke pouring out. A huge amount of fossil fuel is used to mine uranium. Then it has to be crushed in a big crusher, more fossil fuel. And then it's interesting, it goes to Paducah, Kentucky, our uranium, where there are two 1,500 megawatt coal fire plants to enrich the uranium. Coal fire plants pour out CO2. And interestingly, CFC gases are used to cool the pipes containing a very thermally hot uranium hexafluoride. Those pipes are old. There are hundreds of miles of these pipes. They're cracking. And the nuclear industry has been grandfathered out of the Montreal Protocol because CFC must not be released. It's also 10 to 20,000 times more potent as a global warmer than CO2. So the nuclear industry is adding considerably to CFCs to the atmosphere, both which will destroy ozone and add to global warming. Then you have to build the reactor. It's a great big concrete thing. So to say that nuclear power is clean and green is a lie. It produces CO2, it produces global warming, and it produces massive quantities of radioactive waste, which over time are going to produce epidemics of diseases like we've never seen before. And, you know, most mutations now are called deleterious. They cause disease, and my specialty is cystic fibrosis, the most common genetic fatal disease of childhood. And to think of those diseases increasing in time because we're filling our environment up with radioactive isotopes is almost beyond me to talk about. And this is, as I say consistently, this is an issue of global preventive medicine, and we must shut the nuclear industry down. I really don't care. I mean, global warming is very serious, but we know absolutely that all energy now can be produced with renewable energy sources without any nuclear. I almost don't know what to say, except that when my colleagues, pediatricians, hear the story about what it means genetically and in terms of malignancy, they are just absolutely struck dumb. They don't know what to do. And if we have a disease that is incurable, the only recourse is prevention. And here we are trying to treat cancer patients, breast cancer week and the like and the like. Cancer's increasing. Radiation's still falling out from the fallout from the weapons testing days, let alone from these reactors. So it's the whole thing is antithetical to people being healthy down the generations.
Now, France, of course, relies quite a bit on nuclear power for its energy needs, as do other countries like Japan. And I wonder if you can talk about how they deal with their waste and how they manage the expense of nuclear power.
Well, they don't really know what to do with their radioactive waste. Wasn't there an article recently that France is sending some of its radioactive waste to one of the ex-Russian countries? Yeah. It also puts some of its radioactive waste in the sea. Well, that's great because it'll contaminate the fish. Fish swim thousands of miles. You can't taste or smell or see radioactive waste in the fish. And when you get your cancer, maybe 20 years later, because the incubation time for cancer is long, it doesn't wear a little sign saying what it made it, like some strontium-90 in a piece of fish you ate 20 years ago that came from French reactors. Now, the French are pretty arrogant. I've got a French son-in-law who's a count. His sister is a model, but she's also a very famous TV commentator. She knows nothing about nuclear power. Most French don't. The nuclear power industry is totally controlled and run by the French government, and Le Mans's been pretty well subjected to, you know, what the French government says in terms of nuclear power. When I met Mitterrand years ago, he said he would close down the reactors if he got to be president, but of course he didn't. And the French haven't done any studies, epidemiological studies, like the Germans, looking at the incidence of malignancy around their reactors. So the French are really digging a hole for themselves genetically and in terms of malignancy, and they love their food. And some of their food is going to be radioactive, and their wine. And apart from that, when Chernobyl occurred, it made 40% of the European landmass radioactive. I don't buy European food because you don't know what batches are radioactive and what are not. I'm very careful about what I buy. I rang the man in Melbourne, Australia, who tests the food imported from Europe. And I said, what do you do? How do you test it? And he said, well, the computer picks up random batches. That means a lot is not tested. And I said, well, what do you do when you find radioactive food? He said, oh, we dilute it with non-radioactive food. Well, I've just described you can't dilute it. It reconcentrates back in the body. So, you know, just to think that one accident contaminated a whole continent is just almost beyond belief. And it's going to happen again. And I may say that the next nuclear meltdown, if it's in a Western country like Europe or America, that will mark the end of nuclear power. That'll be it.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott in a studio interview with EarthBeat host Daphne Washam in October 2009. Find past programs and how you can help at earthbeatradio.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you for tuning in, and please, get active in your world.